por los soldados apoyados y entrenados por los estadounidenses.
Estas miles de personas que están llegando no es porque vienen para ir a visitar a Hollywood o para ir a ver un partido de los Lakers. Vienen porque están en una situación, una crisis en sus países, y creo que Obama tiene la responsabilidad de darles esta clasificación como refugiados y, por lo tal, aceptarlos aquí con legalización. Si van a aceptar a refugiados de Siria, también tienen que hacer lo mismo para los centroamericanos.
Varios niños tramados por la guerra se convirtieron después en pandilleros y luego fueron deportados a Centroamérica, los mismos que ahora conforman las maras criminales. Luego está el tráfico de drogas, que fluye rumbo norte hacia los drogadictos y el mercado estadounidense, donde después juega un importante papel en el envío de presos latinos y afroamericanos a las prisiones y narcodólares a los bancos del país.
Gente que va deportada de aquí no quisiera ir a delinquir allá, pero no hay nada que hacer. La gente ahora está viviendo una etapa donde el desempleo está súper alto, donde los ricos son más ricos y los pobres son más pobres. Entonces no quedan opciones. Tenemos que también pedirle a la administración de Obama que pare las deportaciones de todos aquellos que van para allá, ¿verdad?, que vienen de las prisiones, que tienen felonías, ¿verdad?, que son deportables, que no han ido a las cortes. Tienen que parar todo eso mientras Centroamérica ve cómo van a enfrentar la situación de tanto deportado.
Observadores y analistas señalan que Washington rehúsa responsabilizarse por sus acciones en Centroamérica, especialmente cuando el Tratado de Libre Comercio impuesto por los Estados Unidos a la región también desplaza millones de obreros. Para el informativo Pacífica en Los Ángeles, reportó Denis Martínez.
El presidente de Argentina, Mauricio Macri, afirma que no tuvo nada que ver con el despido del periodista Víctor Hugo Morales, un fuerte crítico de su gobierno. El popular comunicador fue apoyado por decenas de miles de argentinos que colmaron el martes la Plaza de Mayo. Los detalles con los compañeros del Foro Argentino de Radios Comunitarias, FARCO.
Lo que hace a Víctor Hugo, como en cualquier otro caso, este gobierno tiene una enorme tarea para llevar a cabo en los compromisos que hemos asumido, con lo cual no estamos dedicados a ver qué periodista trabaja y en qué programa de radio o televisión. O sea, no es nuestra tarea, no opinamos. Así que lamento las cosas que ha dicho Víctor Hugo, porque son totalmente falsas. Y
a contraposición con los dichos del presidente, en la jornada de ayer no se acató con lo que decidió la justicia. La Policía Federal impidió el ingreso de Martín Sabatella a las oficinas del AFCA. Esto ocurrió a pesar del fallo de dos jueces que dejaron sin efecto los decretos del Gobierno Nacional vinculados a la Ley de Servicio de Comunicación Audiovisual. De esta forma, queda invalidada, entre otras cuestiones, la intervención de dicho organismo.
Bueno, evidentemente hay una decisión de desobedecer las resoluciones de la justicia, del Poder Judicial. Dos jueces, uno de San Martín, uno de la ciudad, dos jueces federales con absoluta competencia, resolvieron estas medidas precautelares, han sido notificados y evidentemente tienen la decisión de desobedecer la resolución del Poder Judicial y poner la infantería y con la fuerza de seguridad, con la fuerza pública, garantizarse el incumplimiento. Bueno, vamos a informarle a los dos jueces, a los dos juzgados, de que no se ha dado cumplimiento lo que ellos resolvieron, y vamos a hacer también las denuncias penales correspondientes, una vez más por desobediencia a una orden del Poder Judicial.
Mientras tanto, la gente en la calle sigue defendiendo la pluralidad de voces, y ayer en especial a Víctor Hugo Morales. En Buenos Aires, Córdoba y otras ciudades se reunieron organizaciones y vecinos autoconvocados para repudiar el despido del prestigioso periodista. Ante una Plaza de Mayo colmada, el hoy ex periodista de Radio Continental expresó lo siguiente.
Sigamos luchando, y luchar es estar informado. Estar informados es trabajar de ciudadanos. Ustedes también tienen una responsabilidad. Si no hay información, está la locura de la mentira de los medios. Nadie duda que mienten. Pero están los que les han dicho mentime que me gusta, porque antes les insuflaron el odio. Y han llegado a una situación en la que seguramente muchos de los que votaron esta derecha enloquecida que se lleva por delante al Congreso, a la justicia y al periodismo, se deben estar preguntando, ¿era esto lo que me prometieron? ¿No era que iba a haber más república? ¿Es república designar jueces de la Corte Suprema a dedo directamente? No me dijeron que iba a haber más democracia. ¿Es democracia burlarse del Congreso, que es la representación del pueblo? Y entonces, muchísimos, seguramente, ya se dieron cuenta de cuál fue la trampa que hicieron los medios para ellos tener un poder político que represente al poder real. Lo sabemos y tenemos que trabajar sobre esa base de esa información y todavía estar mejor informados. Hagan correr la bolilla. Es necesario que estén informado porque nuestro mecanismo de defensa, y ojalá que me estén escuchando algunos directivos de la radio y que vean esto, que no me animo ni a señalar con el dedo, esta multitud que les está diciendo, no digo mañana, pero pasado mañana, quizás les gustaría escuchar mi programa de radio.
Recordemos que Víctor Hugo fue despedido de Continental luego de 30 años de servicio y cuando todavía le restaba un año de contrato por cumplir.
El pueblo sirio condenó el atentado terrorista que el martes 12 de enero mató a 10 personas e hirió a otras 15 en Estambul, Turquía, y ratificó sus acusaciones al gobierno turco de promover estas bandas armadas en Siria y otros países de la región. Hicham Buenus tiene más detalles.
Ankara anunció que no renunciará a la lucha contra el terrorismo, afirmando que combatirá a todos los grupos extremistas por igual. Declaraciones que el pueblo sirio considera vacías, ratificando sus acusaciones al gobierno turco de promover las bandas armadas en Siria y los demás países de la región.
Manifestamos nuestras sinceras condolencias con las familias de las víctimas del atentado, que consideramos están sufriendo las consecuencias de las políticas del actual gobierno turco. Y hoy en día, Turquía es el blanco del terrorismo que ha promovido en nuestro país, que hasta el momento lo respalda directamente e indirectamente.
Aunque Damasco no se ha pronunciado oficialmente respecto al atentado, los sirios lo calificaron como un crimen despreciable. Aún así, critican que la comunidad internacional, que de inmediato manifestó su solidaridad con el pueblo turco, no hizo lo mismo con Siria, que desde hace casi 5 años sufre de este mal.
Nos duele mucho que los civiles inocentes sean víctimas del terrorismo y estamos en contra de este flagelo que nos agobia a todos. Pero al mismo tiempo condenamos el doble rasero de la comunidad internacional, así como su silencio ante las masacres que cometen los mercenarios extremistas en Siria y en otros países de la región.
Estamos en contra de cualquier acto terrorista en cualquier parte del mundo y por ello instamos a unir los esfuerzos en la lucha contra este mal en el marco de la legalidad internacional, lejos de las medidas unilaterales que al servicio de los intereses occidentales causaron en nuestro país solamente la muerte de cientos de miles.
Mientras, el ejército sirio sigue combatiendo a las bandas extremistas y cerrando las fronteras con Turquía, una lucha que los aliados de Damasco, Moscú y Teherán apoyan, instando al gobierno de Ankara a seguir su ejemplo y sumarse a esta batalla antiterrorista, lejos de la aplicación de estándares y métodos de doble rasero. Hicham Buenus, Telesur, Damasco, Siria.
La Asamblea Nacional de Venezuela ha acatado el fallo del Tribunal Supremo y desincorporará a 3 diputados opositores impugnados. William Parra nos explica.
Ha terminado el primer episodio de lo que había sido calificado como choque de poderes entre el legislativo y el judicial en la vida política venezolana. La Junta Directiva de la nueva Asamblea Nacional ha decidido acatar una sentencia del Tribunal Supremo de Justicia de Venezuela para desincorporar a 3 diputados que habían sido juramentados, pese a que sobre ellos estaba emitida una orden cautelar que pedía que no fueran juramentados. Tras la renuncia que presentaron estos 3 diputados electos por el Estado Amazonas, la Junta Directiva de la Asamblea Nacional decidió someter a votación la desincorporación de estos 3 diputados. Por un lado, los chavistas aseguraron que de esta manera no se daba cumplimiento a la sentencia del Tribunal Supremo de Justicia y finalmente la Asamblea decidió incorporar en la decisión esa palabra, que la Asamblea Nacional acata esta sentencia del Tribunal Supremo de Justicia. Veamos el momento en que el presidente de la Asamblea, Henry Ramos Alup, decidió y anunció que se acataba esta decisión del máximo tribunal de la justicia venezolano.
Acata o se cumple o se observa, palabra sinónima. No tenemos ningún problema con decir los ciudadanos diputados si eso satisface y contribuye a que usted... Así está la Cámara con sus diputados a cumplir con su deber constitucional. Que tenga constancia de que cumplimos, acatamos y observamos.
Al tiempo que ponían sobre sus curules fotos del presidente Hugo Chávez y del libertador de América Simón Bolívar, la bancada oficialista calificó esta decisión de la Junta Directiva de la Asamblea Nacional como una victoria popular.
Aquí concluye esta edición del Informativo Pacífica. Agradecemos la colaboración de Denise Martínez y todas las personas que hicieron posible este programa, el mismo que es producido gracias a las generosas donaciones de las y los radioyentes. Sus contribuciones son siempre bienvenidas en nuestro sitio de internet www.kpfk.org. Se quedan en compañía de nuestros colegas de Contragolpe y mañana jueves a la misma hora estarán en sintonía con los compañeros de Nuestra Voz y Enfoque Latino. A nombre de Toshli y de Norma Martínez, se despide tu amigo de siempre, Fernando Velázquez. Gracias por acompañarnos.
Escuche Nuestra Voz, programa de información, análisis y cultura, donde su voz es la que cuenta. Todos los jueves a las 9:30 a 11 p.m. aquí, en KPFK 90.7 FM Los Ángeles. Nuestra Voz es parte de APE, Asociación de Programadores y Programadoras en Español de KPFK. Y recuerde, les esperamos todos los jueves a las 9:30 de la noche.
¿Tienes un auto que ya no camina y solamente está estorbando? ¿Sale más barato el transporte público que llenarlo de gasolina? ¿Te quieres deshacer de él, pero no sabes cómo? Pues ahora puedes donar tu auto y apoyar a tu estación favorita. Y no importa la condición, apóyanos donando tu carcacha vieja al 1-877-KPFK-AUTO, 1-877-573-5286. Y apoya a tu estación favorita. Nosotros nos encargaremos de todo.
KPFK 90.7 FM Los Ángeles y 98.7 FM Santa Bárbara. Y a través del mundo en kpfk.org.
Hi, R. Duck here, reaching out to you, our friendly listeners of FRSC, the finest radio in Santa Cruz. We ask you to keep an eye out and let us know for a new studio location. We need something urgently, preferably by September 20th. If you have such a location, let us know. We can give you $500 as a thank you gift. It needs electricity. We can connect up an internet. And a bathroom is also required. Contact FRSC at freakradio.org. And we'll see you on Friday night, 8:30 p.m. until Friday night. At 8:30 p.m., thank you. And thanks for your ongoing help to make such mischief possible.
This is Ward Churchill saying, get yourself a mind transplant. Listen to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101 FM.
And coming up next on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org, it's a combination of a kind of a brief update on what's been happening and as well as a flashback from way back in March of 1999, part of an earlier show. I'm kind of out of combat at the time, and I'm trying to... Well, give you folks some interesting stuff to chew on, mostly historical, so stay tuned.
I'm tired of moon songs, of star and of June songs. They simply make me mad. And ditties romantic drive me nearly frantic. I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking. Why sing of stars above? For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Let meaning shine from every line, or I won't love you. Sing me of wars and sing me of bread lines. Tell me of front page news. Sing me of strikes and last minute headlines. Dress your observation in syncopation. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must get hot with what is what, or I won't love you. I want a song that's satirical, putting the mirror into miracle. It must be packed with social fact, or I won't love you. Sing me of kings and conferences martial. Tell me of mills and mines. Sing me of courts that aren't impartial. What's to be done with them? Tell me in rhythm. Sing me a song with social significance. There's nothing else that will do. It must be tense with common sense, or I won't love you.
And welcome again to Bathrobes, Pierre's Broadsides. I'm Robert Norris. This is a twice-weekly show concerning civil rights for poor people, mostly outside, and the actions of administrative hacks and other authorities who are essentially trying to run them out of town or drive them out of sight. Unfortunately, I hate to have to put it that way, but that's really the way it is. There's only going to be about a half an hour of new material here in this show. Usually I do 2 hours of new material on Thursday nights, but the problem is I have medical stuff I've got to deal with, and therefore I'm going to be playing for you an older show, or at least part of an older show, from March of 1999. And that older show is, I'll mention it later in more detail as we get closer to the actual playing of the show, but it's quite relevant now because we are entering another period soon, and there will be at least a nominal consideration of changes in the sleeping ban, that section of the camping ordinance which makes it crime to actually fall asleep after 11 o'clock at night. And the same issues were coming up in 1999. It's a part of a three-month-long formal consideration by the city council. A group called the Task Force to Examine the Camping Ordinance was actually happening then. That was, again, what, 17, 16 years ago, something like that? Anyway, but more recently, actually, last night at City Council, well, it would be Tuesday night as you hear this broadcast, the City Council voted to both make it more of a crime to be homeless, in this case, making it a crime to try to park your RV anywhere in town by changing the legality of parking in more than one parking space, even if you're paying for it, even if you're there in a legal way, essentially directing and giving power to the city engineer, the traffic engineer, to restripe the city wherever he wants, only directing him to do it in certain areas, like that near the Lighthouse Field area, I believe it is, up West Cliff Drive, where they want to get rid of the big RVs up there. And this primarily, I believe, impacts homeless people, though I haven't surveyed it. I can't tell you for sure that that's the reason, but there's generally been a lot of talk about drug dealing, meth vans on wheels, and that kind of scare stuff. Well, you found it in the Tuesday Morning Sentinel, which had syringes on the beach, washing up, and Annalisa Cube, who has made an industry out of paranoia and hate crime speech against homeless people while masquerading as a public safety person. I think she actually believes she's a public safety person as well. Not saying it's false, although it's hard to tell what's inside a person's mind. She's the head of Take Back Santa Cruz, or one of the co-founders. Just to divert for a moment, the issue came up at the Huff meeting on Wednesday. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, and Huff members were quite skeptical of this story, this front page story by Stephen Baxter, which sensationalizes the appearance of, what was it, 28 syringes and one needle on the beach. And the point, I think, is not that this it might well be a health hazard, but the issue is, for example, where does it come from? Does it come from medical supplies illegally dumped? Does it come from, as Annalisa Cube has suggested, the improper provision of needles to IV drug users to protect the health of themselves and the community? Where does it come from? And this is being used, this scare tactic around needles coming to council and shaking needles. Lynn Robinson, the former mayor, was particularly emphatic in this whole approach to create a new right-wing reactionary backlash social agenda that criminalizes and demonizes drug users, intravenous drug users and addicts and folks who are outside, and also homeless people, because they are lumped in with this group, and it's the new mythology is that this is a too welcoming a town, we provide too many wonderful services for the homeless, that it's just an easy ride here in Santa Cruz, which I think is horseshit, but that is the mythology that's promulgated by Rochelle Narayan, David Chereza's, former council member Lynn Robinson, who I think now is doing some alleged charity work up in Felton area, of all places, Cynthia Matthews. In any case, they passed a measure, last fall they passed a measure making it illegal to park RVs at night unless you have permits, and you can't get a permit unless you are a resident, and homeless people are declared unpersons, or in this case, unresidents. They can't be residents, even though the federal government says they have a right to vote. If they're in a certain place, they are residing there. So, sorry, Mr. and Mrs. Middle America, you have to deal with this issue whether you like it or not. But not in Santa Cruz, apparently, not in liberal Santa Cruz. So the measure that passed last night on the second reading, Tuesday night, was the power to, as mentioned, give the city traffic engineer the power to restripe the entire city and make it illegal to use more than one parking space. So essentially to shrink parking space areas and so make it practically impossible, or difficult at least, for those with RVs to park their RVs in town. Now, there's some controversy as to whether this is going to run afoul of the Coastal Commission, and I'm not entirely sure where this is going, but it was passed last night. It was voted on Tuesday night, and it was voted for by Don Lane, who has been masquerading or trying to persuade himself and the rest of us that he's a great fan of homeless services and basic civil rights and compassion and so forth. And I don't doubt that he believes all this stuff. And in fact, he's coming up with a proposal, which, as I mentioned before, is relevant to what we were doing 20 years ago, what the council was claiming to be doing as well, which is looking for a more reasonable, responsible, humanistic, and just plain sensible approach to homeless people sleeping at night in Santa Cruz when they have no lodging. So, that was one measure that was passed on Tuesday afternoon, actually, at the afternoon session. A second measure that was passed was a sort of rudimentary beginnings of a city grudging interest in or a warming center area. A warming center project has been pressed and advertised quite extensively by Brent Adams and Stacy Falls, if I have that name right, I hope, for the last couple of years. And I've mentioned it rhetorically, along with Dennis Etler and others, as obviously a need, and particularly when people are freezing to death in Monterey and San Jose, as they were in the last month, and suffering here in Santa Cruz. So the staff didn't like the idea, though they agreed to come back with the council directed them to come back with a series of proposals and cost estimates. They didn't, as Brent Adams clearly points out, and I think in an effective email to the city council, which is available for the community, which I wasn't able to read when I was actually hearing the debate on television on Tuesday night, but then could read later. And he made some very good points, which I think are relevant because, as I've said many a time, the staff is the group that controls the city. It's not the city council. It's the city council's staff. And that being the case, we have to look to see what they're doing to really understand where the power lies and where the policy lies. And here's what Brent wrote. Regarding agenda item 15, this being heard on Tuesday by the city manager's office, I'm dismayed because it doesn't seem to have met the requirements of the motion that was voted on by 4 council members in late November. Rather than bringing recommendations about costs and liability insurance of the warming center program use of the city facility, they've combined the 2 motions that have been voted on into a single item that only recommends focusing on the county plan. This is part of Rochelle Neroyan and the city council majority's famous, leave it to the county, we're doing too much already, let's wait for the federal government to do something, we don't want to do anything alone, we're too nice, we're too humanistic already, you know, we're inviting all these bums to come to town. It's part of the old get-the-bums-out-of-town approach, which treats homeless people as bums, in essence, treats poor people who are outside as bums, while at the same time claiming great liberal concern for their well-being and saying, we want just smart services and, you know, we'll support that, but not free meals, for heaven's sakes, you know, that kind of thing, which, of course, have not been available for homeless people since June or July at the Homeless Lack of Services Center and don't seem to be ready to be coming anytime soon to be restored, even though it was really a small part of the budget for the Homeless Lack of Services Center. It seemed more of an ideological or policy decision that they made to shut down those meals. Now, it is true if you are in the homeless, in the winter armory shelter, if you lock yourself in at 4:30 and troop up there to a sort of a militarized scene up there through the militarized Homeless Lack of Services Center, which has a security gate, an ID, locked area, can't use a bathroom at night if you're a member of the community. A change from the previous policies of the Homeless Lack of Services Center under earlier management. You can get a meal if you are part of that program of 100 people who go up there. Of course, there are 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people in Santa Cruz. Some say it's less. I think it's probably still about that number, but I have no, you know, clear stats on it. But the meals have been cut, and you can't walk in to get a meal if you're hungry. Food Not Bombs, however, does still serve on the weekends. I remind people, Saturday and Sunday, 4 to 6, and there's still a significant crowd of folks there. Red Church serves on Monday, although Joe Miller, who runs that meal, will be leaving his post as pastor in a couple of weeks. So look for a change as the Cynthia Matthews faction may grow stronger, though it's not clear that's exactly what's going to happen. Anyway, Brent Adams continues, and the issue of the warming center has been an important one because it's cold winters, it's El Nino weather, and it's illegal to sleep outside in Santa Cruz on top of that. Even if you try to shelter yourself, that's even more of a crime. For example, the Freedom Sleepers, who held Freedom Sleep Out 27 in front of City Hall on Tuesday night, good for them. They have found they do not get tickets for even putting up a tent on the sidewalk. But if they try to venture under the eaves of the sacred city council buildings, they get driven away by first alarm security thugs. We're having a thing called Thug Patrol, if you're interested. Call 831-423-4833 for more information. 831-423-4833, keeping a very visible focus on the first alarm security thugs that the city council have hired to harass homeless people in the library, harass homeless people around City Hall, harass the Freedom Sleepers, and harass people in the downtown area as well, who are poor and seem out of place to some of the nervous merchants and right-wing folks who are pressuring and essentially backing and putting into power the city council majority. Although, and frankly, the entire city council majority has really been pretty much in that category for decades, really, here in Santa Cruz. Brent Adams continues, the warming center issue is what he's talking about. He wanted the city council to follow up on its resolution of November.
And what he wrote them was, "I'm mostly worried that this proposal by the staff will leave many people unprotected on the coldest nights, because the plan that I've seen so far is limited to 10 nights, 50 people, and 32 degrees or below. We've already been open 9 nights this year and are geared to open 30 more, and that's only in Santa Cruz, not North County at large. I believe the city can and would do both, allow warming center program use of a city facility, and vote to support the county's effort. There really isn't very much to lose and very much to gain in helping us to do what we do best, take really good care of our guests and the host properties we utilize. This is a community effort, and we'd like to see the city that we're operating in offer a very small stake in that. It should be noted that two of our host locations, we have to awaken our guests at a cruel 5:30 a.m. at the Depot Park Freight Building. There are no scheduled events that start earlier than 10 a.m., and if there are, then we'll just not be there on those days. I believe it's of paramount importance that the City Council support Warming Center in precisely this way. Our program has been held to an appropriately high standard. We're grateful to see city leaders taking the stands that they do." He's, again, pouring it on a little thick, as Brent often does. It's part of his program, which I don't like much, but I guess that's politics. "At this point, I think a few pointed questions should be asked about the winter shelter program at the Armory," which really is his rival program, or it isn't really a rival, because you can't get to the Armory, you can't walk in there. You have to be, there at 4:30 and driven up there by their buses and vans. Although I understand, some have told me it's quite tolerable. So there's differences of opinion about the Winter Armory shelter, but it does require a much more constrained, takes up a much larger block of time, and it's not run by volunteers in the same way that Brent's program is. "Does the winter shelter at the Armory feature on-site overnight monitors who've been trained to deal with people with mental health challenges? Does the winter shelter at the Armory feature a lockdown scenario? Does security personnel amount to visual oppression, or do they soothe or trigger people with mental health challenges?" That's, of course, a question often for the first alarm security thugs who are patrolling the Freedom Sleepers, as they've been doing every night for the last 27 weeks or thereabouts. "What are the tools that security personnel use to aid in dealing with people with mental health challenges?" He sounds a little like a social service bureaucrat, but let that go. "Does anyone on Santa Cruz City Council know what the winter shelter, the Armory, is actually like?" And that's certainly a very good question. And he presents his program, his advertising. He did a slideshow with Stacy. Then eventually, City Council voted to allow 5 nights, but it wasn't clear whether they were going to require further insurance or security, and also maybe a staff person all night from the city, and they also removed Loudon Nelson at Don Lane and Micah Posner's initiative. It was a very highly limited response. It was slightly less limited than the original staff report, because the staff was very intent on just saying, "Leave it to the county. We don't want anything to do with this. It's got too much this and too much that." At least that, to me, I think, is the subtext that I read in the staff report. So in any case, there was also that's what happened. I don't know. I think Brent took a very positive perspective on this. I think he felt that this is essentially the city council being dragged kicking and screaming into recognizing they have to do something, or else not just look like idiots, but may be legally liable for deaths that are happening, and also politically liable, which is probably more important for them than legally liable. And so we'll see how this works out. I don't know that there's a lot of heavy rain or low temperatures in the next few days, but I will hopefully continue to get some reports on this, although, as I said, my own situation is such that I'm not going to be able to be reporting as much as possible. Huff is continuing to do its good work, insofar as we meet, chatter, drink coffee, and plot and scheme, and sometimes get out there on the streets. Our latest project is Thug Watch, as I call it, which is to keep an eye on first alarm security in ways that are very, very visible to the community. Large signs that say, "This man is spending your tax dollars to harass poor people outside. Would you like to donate?" We could always have a panhandle in for the first alarm security, which might be an amusing little incident or approach to use. So there's that. If you want to be a part of any of this, you can give a call to the Huff line at 423-HUFF, 423-HUFF, area code 831-423-HUFF, and leave me your contact info, put you on the Huff email list, and we'll try to get you to get to work and do some stuff, and to or get to play, too. It's kind of a combination of play and work. Hopefully coming up on Sunday, I'm going to be playing the latest chapter in the kind of sad saga of the shutting down of the 24-hour bathroom, which is a bathroom that was open until December 23rd across from New Leaf Market on Soquel in the Soquel Garage. And tune in on Sunday at 9:30, and the long show will probably have some a long interview with one of the city staff who cleans up the bathroom, who's a supporter of the idea of a 24-hour bathroom, but his ideas and mine don't entirely jibe, but he has some interesting things to say. There'll also be an interview with Carol Denny, who is an activist probably familiar to some of you who listen to this show regularly. She's a Berkeley folk singer and homeless activist who has been fighting up there in Berkeley to, struggling in Berkeley to change, fight the changes that the mayor, Tom Bates, and his right-wing council majority, does this sound familiar, are trying to impose on a much more outspoken council minority. You don't just have Micah Posner groveling and apologizing to the staff for his votes, but you have council members angrily walking out, denouncing the rest of the council, speaking up strongly in no uncertain terms about the kind of bigotry that's going on. Bigotry is a word that Micah Posner and Don Lane don't use. Coming up in February is now, I guess this is more to the point of what I'm going to be playing in the next hour and a half. This is an old show which has a number of interesting aspects to it, and it's from March of 1999. What we have coming up in February of 2016 is a proposal by Don Lane, former mayor, which I've mentioned before on this show, which you can find described on the Facebook page of Don Lane. Back in October, he wrote a long woe is me, mea culpa, about how he really felt that, you know, sleeping should not be a crime, and he's made some mistakes, but it's really those evil, bad, nasty, bad activists who are the problem, but still he wishes, you know, that he could do things differently, and he hopes to, and he does indeed take a position that says sleeping is not a crime and should not be a crime and has to be specifically addressed, and he apparently is proposing, although it's not formally been made public, but it's kind of been circulated around. I guess it's kind of public. It was presented to church groups and homeless activists, and I got a copy of it too, though not directly from Don Lane, which in essence strikes the word sleeping from all the descriptions of what constitute camping, which is nice, and it's, you know, it's, it does address in almost in the kind of the technical way the human rights violation that is happening every night when any police officer or security guard or a ranger comes up and says, you can't sleep because it's against the law. And this is in a situation where there's no place for them to go. They say, oh, wait, there's some place, some capacity at the armory. There are 20 spaces open out of 100 with a 1,500 to 2,000 homeless people in town on the streets. This has been essentially exploded as a bad argument that can't even be used in court to justify a criminal charge. And so the city has instead taken different approaches. Oh, if you get on the waiting list, we'll dismiss your ticket. Oh, if you get a letter from the Homeless Lack of Services Center, which they aren't giving out much these days, you know, we'll have the judge or basket level, basement level basket, as I call her, dismiss your ticket. But the consequence remains the same. You still have people woken up, harassed, told to leave, and given no place to go, having their health imperiled, their sleep imperiled, their dignity imperiled, their property also imperiled by this kind of crap. And it is continues to go on. And it was happening before as well. And that's why I'm playing this older version, as well as the fact that I need to I don't have the time to put in an hour and a half of new material right now, but I'm hoping that you will find this material interesting, those of you who are interested in the issue of the rights of homeless people. And also, some of you are old-timers will hear some older voices that you haven't heard for a while. There's going to be a particular discussion. It's going to jump immediately into this tape, into the discussion of the Pottinger decision, and I believe this was before a second ruling. The Pottinger decision went through several iterations. It was a decision in Miami, Florida, by federal judge Clyde Atkins that essentially said you cannot arrest homeless people for life-sustaining misdemeanors unless you have legal places for them to go. So he insisted the city of Miami set up safe zones, and you're going to hear the discussion of what happened there. And then they eventually did a settlement where they agreed to build some shelters instead or in addition. And I'm probably going to try to catch up with ACLU attorneys in Miami at some point to get their latest update now, 17 years later. It's the historical sweep, folks. You're also going to hear David Silva, who often calls in briefly to the show, passionately speaks out for homeless civil rights, and then sort of disappears. He often gives some movie reviews sometimes, too. But 17 years ago, David Silva was much more specific in these issues and much more deeply involved as even sort of a middleman negotiator with what we thought then was the city council that was liberal or progressive, truly progressive, elected in 1998. Three council members, Christopher Crone, Keith Sugar, now dead, and Tim Fitzmaurice, came into power. And we thought that with Catherine Byers, who was a holdover member of the council, we had a majority of people who would end the sleeping ban. Well, some of us thought that. I wasn't terribly convinced of it. And it didn't happen. In fact, the opposite happened. We got worse laws. Well, we got a stall for a long period of time, and then we got worse laws as new council members cycled in. But David Silva was instrumental in fighting this, and the dialogue that the two of us have, I think, may give you some examples of what dialogue some of us may be having in February when Don Lane proposes his new law, if he does, which is likely to get, well, you never can tell. It might get more votes than you think, but the problem, of course, with simply decriminalizing sleeping but not allowing for real camping areas is people can't cover up against the cold, and it just simply serves as some kind of legal protection for the city. It says, see, we're not criminalizing sleeping, it's just camping. We're criticizing, you know, but that has the same practical impact on people who have no shelter. So let's hear a song, and this is from Penske, who is a loyal Sub Rosa worker, and she's also was one of the Santa Cruz 11, of which I was too, people who fought to establish a community center and were rewarded with massive felony charges as part of the attempt to crush the Occupy movement, a successful attempt, I might add. But she sings well. We're going to hear her song, then we're going to go directly into the 1999, I guess it's the March 28th, 1999, Bathrop Spears Broadside Show.
Rise like lions after slumber in unvanquishable numbers, and shake your chains to earth like dew, which in sleep have fallen on you. We are many, they are few. We are many, they are few.
Sorry we're a little late. Apparently somebody wasn't watching the skipping machine here in the studio and we had a problem, which was fixed. But, hey, 2.5 hours now, more or less, you're going to be listening, we hope, to Civil Rights for the Poor. That's what we're up to. That's special reports from New York City, a live interview with Robert Letterman, Julian's Reign of Terror, and the attempt of people in the 14th day of protest to stop that reign.
And unfortunately, you're not going to hear Robert Letterman on this particular part of the march 28th Bathrop Spears broadsides, but you will hear some other interesting stuff, so stay tuned.
We have local reports and reports from Santa Barbara and from Florida. Stay tuned.
Joining us this morning, March 28th, 1999 edition of Bathrop Spear's Broadsides. I'm your host, Bathrop Spear. That's a kind of a joking reference to Robespierre and to Bathrobe. For those of you who are wondering what that name means, it has to do with the kind of clothing I wear at protests. When you're out there trying to defend the right of homeless people to sleep, it's sometimes amusing to have a bathrobe with you, and it also keeps you a little warmer. So that's what I go by, Bathrop Spear. And we have a call-in show here that you're tuned to on Free Radio Santa Cruz. The number is easy to dial if you can find 35 cents or a phone that you can use. It's 427-3772, 427-FRSC, Free Radio Santa Cruz. And we will give your calls priority because we think that you are really one of the key elements of this show. And I'm, frankly, more interested in hearing from you than in hearing myself talk. Well, I don't know how true that is, but it should be true, and I'm going to act as though it were true. So give us a call at 427-3772 if you want to discuss any of the things we're talking about or related subjects that you think we should be talking about but we're not talking about. We're going to join an interview in progress with an ACLU person in Florida, Miami, Florida. We contacted him about a month ago to discuss the issue of what happened down there in 1992 when the federal courts ruled, Clyde Atkins, a very notable federal judge, ruled that homeless people could not be arrested for, let's say, falling asleep or doing life-sustaining activities unless there were places for them to do those activities that were legal. So, for example, if you had a law against a homeless person warming himself or herself with a fire or sleeping at night, as we do in Santa Cruz. It's illegal to sleep in Santa Cruz after 11 at night, as most of you know, outside or in a vehicle. And you couldn't make it criminal to do that unless there were a shelter for that person to go to or a safe zone for them to go to. And this was the case for the last 7 years. It's still the case in Florida. And Mike Rutkin's comments notwithstanding that this would cause some sort of magnet influx if people were allowed to sleep at night and had their civil rights restored. It did no such thing, according to the ACLU and other social service agencies we spoke with. So we're going to join Alan here and continue this conversation we had with him, let you kind of in on the ground floor. He's very articulate and talks about the impacts of this decision, which essentially restored the rights of homeless people in one fell swoop in 1992.
So let's join him.
You know, I think is really something that's the flip side to all this stuff on the criminalization, which I think really needs to be touted, is what happened here in Miami as a result of the decision is the 1992 decision. Is the judge basically said, listen, guys, to the city, you're arresting people, and they have no place else to go. It violates the Constitution to arrest someone off the street for sleeping when they have to sleep somewhere, and they are forced to be out on the streets for whatever reason. For the involuntarily homeless who have no place else to go, it violates the Constitution. As a result of that, what the city did, because they don't really want homeless people on the street, they saw an option. They said, well, if we can't arrest homeless people because they have no place else to go, let's give them someplace else to go. So at that point, the city and the county really pulled together and forced and then developed like this homeless task force, which brought together a lot of sort of the movers and shakers in Miami to say, what are we going to do about this? And they actually developed a plan, which I think has some real negative intent. I mean, basically, they just wanted to build shelter beds so that they can then arrest people. I understand that, but what went with that is they brought in millions and millions and millions of dollars to put into homeless programming, to put into shelters and put into transitional housing, to the point of, since 1992, Miami's brought in about $120 million.
Wow. And how does that compare with the amount of money previously being spent?
Oh, it was prior to 1990 or 19... The lawsuit was filed in 88. The late 80s, early 90s, hardly anything.
Meaning?
There was no organized effort.
So it was less than $1 million, or...?
You know what, I have to look at some old newspapers. If I can find anything, I'll send it to you. But we're talking insignificant amounts of money. Now, of course, some of this goes together with the fact that HUD was funding more, you know, was putting more money out there. But nonetheless, what Miami did and what Dade County, which is Miami is in Dade County, was really pull this together. I'm not happy with a lot of the decisions that they made or even the directions that they went in. But nonetheless, a lot of money went into homeless programs. The goal of business and the goal of sort of the politicians was let's just open up the beds so we can get these people off the streets. On the other hand, there's programs for homeless people. So it's not just, you know, let's eradicate the laws, let's delete the laws and let people live on the street.
It was the reality that all these visible people required suddenly a lot of shelter because you didn't want them around. You couldn't just arrest them. You can't put them off the side.
Right, and I think the notion that arrest was just, you know, you arrest them, they do their 20 days, and then they're out. You know, so we were trying to say, well, arrest doesn't do anything except maybe, you know, the night before some big event, you know, if the president's coming to town or, you know, whatever it is, you can clean up the streets and put everybody in jail, but that doesn't deal with it.
Was there ever a cost analysis service for putting them in jail with shelters?
No, I mean, I think you could probably, you know, you could probably do a survey of what the general costs are, you know, the rescue mission nights.
Right. It's been argued around here that it's considerably less to house and feed and so forth than to jail.
I think that's true, and I think there's probably data out there, although I can't tell you that I would tell you how to put your hands on it.
Now, how broad was the jurisdiction in which the Pottinger decision applied, and what happened in other areas that you know of?
It's just the city of Miami.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't apply anywhere else.
Well, how is it that Fort Lauderdale suddenly set up a tenth city and had that going for years and years? That sounds like that they weren't a bunch of good cities. They had to act.
Yeah, I think because they wanted to try and consolidate. I mean, I think they just wanted to know that homeless people were in one place.
Because what I heard was that they wanted to close the parks, and they couldn't do so legally without, you know, having a legal place for them to go. That's what a social service provider
know that they were legally. I don't think they were legally bound. They surely were not legally bound by the Pottinger decision.
There might have been some other decision you're not aware of, or
I don't know that it was actually legally required. Right. I don't know. I think they did it because
apprehension about a future decision, perhaps.
Yeah. And I think they thought it was just like let's not look like we're as harsh as we are. And but I don't know that. You know, I even though Fort Lauderdale is only about 30-35 miles away, it's another county, and I say that I stay on top of what's going on up there. But I know they've just closed down their tent city, or about to close down their tent city because they just built a homeless shelter.
That's the next question I wanted to ask you, and I guess that really goes with your task force. Do you think that the effect of, if you were to predict, and of course you can't because you don't know what our city is like, we have a much smaller city and so forth, and it's a different scene, but I was told in Fort Lauderdale when I talked to social service providers there that the effect of having, or maybe it was Miami that I talked to somebody in, but that the effect of this decision, I mean, maybe this is what you're saying around the task force, is that having a lot of people outside didn't result in, as some of us fear here, a backlash against the homeless, so they would stop putting money into social services. Rather, much more money was put into social services to deal with the problems homeless people face.
That's right. And basically, by the judge saying, listen, you can't just arrest these people, he was saying, you can only arrest them if they refuse to go somewhere. You know, if they have an alternative, and they, you know, in other words, what he was kind of saying is, look, you don't have a right, if you've got a place to live, if you've got another place to go, you don't have a right to violate a law. Your only right to violate the law is if you have no place else to go.
Right. The problem we have is, of course, we don't have that kind of necessarily liberal judiciary, nor does any other jurisdiction, or let's say enlightened judge.
Nor do we really.
Oh, really?
It just, with just the luck of the draw and something about this, and I guess it sort of just hit this judge. I mean, that just happens.
What was the reaction of neighborhoods and did people start sleeping in neighborhoods and sleeping downtown in business areas that alarmed the horses and that sort of thing?
Well, I mean, what was behind all this is that people were sleeping in, you know, doorways and urinating in front of people's businesses so that, you know, it smelled like urine, and business people were just pissed.
As a consequence of this decision, was there a change in where people slept? In 1992.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I can't. Not that I'm aware. Well, you know, the safe zones opened, so a lot of people went over to the safe zones because they were in effect for just a very short time. So they did do that, but I don't know. I think that the changes in where people slept, I think, were a result of the fact that they started closing down parking lots and offering people places to stay. They closed down sort of the major congregations of people, and so I think we have, as a result in Miami, we have much less of, you know, congregants of 60 or 30 or 50 homeless people in one place, and they're much more small pockets of like two or three homeless people or some large groups around churches, but it was not necessarily a result of the decision, though.
One of the concerns of people here in Santa Cruz is that if the sleeping ban is lifted, this is kind of an ironic concern, but if we lift the sleeping ban in the industrial zone, this will somehow result in people feeling they can sleep in the neighborhood, and it's a very irrational argument. Or they're afraid that if it's legal to sleep somewhere, then people will be sleeping in. We were on the line talking to Janet Riley, and Janet, you're with the Legal Aid Service of Broward County?
Well, sort of legal services.
Evil work that I have done.
I don't have the name of the group. It's actually on the box, but I've only got the tape. It's a fine tape, lots of old Union songs, and the Union of the homeless, of the poor, of the many of us who are getting screwed over and watching more work being done to get less product as the environment gets degraded away. Well, we need that kind of a union, one big union kind of thing, and I hope we get more of it. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz 96.3, and I'm your host for the moment, Robert Norse. This is a two-and-a-half-hour show. We're doing civil rights today and almost every day when I do my show, twice a week, Thursdays 6 to 8, Sundays from 11 to 1:30. We're listening to an ACLU person talking to us from Miami, Florida, with some really interesting stats that, of course, fly in the face of the fables and fantasies propounded by the, I'm glad to say, the minority on the Santa Cruz City Council. Unfortunately, the majority on the Santa Cruz City Council has kept the buyer's sleeping ban firmly in place, so it's still illegal for homeless people to sleep in Santa Cruz, even though in 3 days there's going to be less than 40 sleeping spaces, probably less than 30, on the floors of the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Church Program for more than 500 to 1,500 homeless people. And this is all being stage managed with a straight face by Mayor Catherine Byers, who is also the kingmaker on the board of directors of the main monopoly, I would say, the only emergency homeless shelter provider in Santa Cruz. I call it the monopoly provider because
They're the ones that do it. That's the Homeless Services Center, which umbrellas the Interfaith Satellite Shelter Program. This is the same mayor who ran us around town, up and down, through Hill and Dale, over Bigot and bulrushes, in order to do nothing, essentially, except lower the fines on the sleeping crime and the covering up with blanket crime that still shames our city and our city's law code. We're going to be talking shortly, I hope, with Attorney Kate Wells. I'm going to try to get a hold of her. She's been playing a major part in Lawyers Against the Sleeping Ban, as well as running interference for medical marijuana folks. We had a great hemp festival last weekend, and now, of course, it's back to drug war as usual with the city police and the courts that are making their living, as are most of the attorneys of that court, off of this drug war. And, of course, we haven't heard a peep from the city council, the great liberal city council, that it's 4-3 majority about ending the drug war. That really is, a key thing we've got to work on. Let's turn back to Florida for a moment. I'm kind of running all over the map. I got a very interesting email. It's actually 2 months old. It's on January 25th, but it reads as follows. City councilman proposes camp for the homeless, Jacksonville, Florida. Homeless people who refuse to go to shelters may soon have a new option. City Councilman Howard Dale proposed a new measure that would allow a camping area downtown so that homeless people don't have to go to jail if they refuse to go to a shelter or if the shelters are full. An aside here, Florida is so much ahead of us on this issue that they've actually reached the point, thanks to a federal judge's order, Judge Atkins' Pottinger decision order, that you cannot arrest someone for sleeping unless there's a shelter bed available. Well, apparently Howard Dale is now going further and saying you shouldn't have to arrest homeless people who are, for various reasons, unwilling to go indoors into crowded, disease-spreading, privacy-absent type shelters. He is proposing taking a step even beyond the kinds of protections that we tried to get unsuccessfully here in Santa Cruz that would say no tickets if there are no shelter spaces available. That was proposed by Councilmember Sugar as a last-minute kind of a slipshod makeshift measure, but didn't get anywhere, mainly because he and DeCrone and others did not advocate for it enough in advance and educate the public, in my mind. But here in Florida, we have Councilman Dale actually saying, well, you've already got it so that you can't be arrested unless there's a shelter bed if you're sleeping outside. But now we're going to say, even if there's a shelter bed, we'll give you a third option, a campground. Let's hear what he says about this. Just 1 year ago, Dale called for jailing people who slept on public or private property and refused to go to a shelter after one warning. In March, Dale decided to look more into the issue after an annual census showed that for the first time, the city's homeless population topped 3,000 people and exceeded available shelter beds by about 400. We should contrast this, by the way, as another aside, to Santa Cruz, where the available shelter space now is about, let's get very generous, 220 floor bed spaces for 500 to 1,500 people, and in 3 days it'll be less than 30 for that same number. So it's a huge discrepancy in Santa Cruz. Whereas in Jacksonville, apparently there was a relatively small discrepancy, or at least I suspect there was a bigger one, but they found only a small one, 400. Since then, Dale has been meeting with groups, including the sheriff's office, business and property owners who object to nuisance behavior by vagrants, and with advocates for the homeless. For a possible outdoor camp, Dale said he was looking at a piece of property near the sheriff's office and the I.M. Sulzbacher Center for the Homeless, the city's largest shelter and counseling center. People would have to bring their own sleeping bags, but access to bathrooms would be provided, and there would be outside monitoring to make sure the camp is safe. Besides offering the idea of an outdoor camp, an approach used by cities like Tampa with apparent success, and of course this gives the lie to what Mike Rutkin had said at the last council meeting, which is that there were no campgrounds operational. They all failed. Apparently Tampa sees their success, if this story is to be believed. I haven't checked in specifically into Tampa, but there was a campground at Fort Lauderdale which was closed not because it was a failure, but because they had opened up other shelters. Dale's new bill would allow the courts to substitute counseling at city shelters for jail time. Also, it would set up a homeless shelter coordinator whom police would call to check if any beds were available before arresting someone. If there aren't any beds and the outdoor camping area is full, then the ordinance wouldn't be enforced, Dale said Friday. The proposal was scheduled for discussion in 2 weeks, and because it's the weekend, I haven't yet been able to get back to find out what happened. This is a story dated January from Jacksonville, Florida, which talks about city councilman there who previously was up for arresting homeless people unless they went to shelters, and they were providing shelter spaces for homeless people. Now he's saying, let them go to campgrounds as well, and let's set up counseling as an alternative. In other words, it sounds like civilization has made it to Jacksonville, but not quite leaped the gap over here to Santa Cruz. I always thought Santa Cruz was more liberal than Florida, but I guess I'm going to have to think again. So, before we leap to a live interview, which I'm hoping to get, let's play a little song for you, which was given to me by some of the scallywags here at the station. I've been talking in the past about the Cherry Pie 3. These are the three activists in San Francisco with the Biotic Baking Brigade who presented Willie Brown with a pie in the eye for his pie in the sky poo-poo against homeless people. That is to say, his sweeps, his attacks on homeless people, the huge increase in the death rate of homeless people under Willie Brown, his sweeps of the parks, his failure to significantly expand shelter, and his closing down public spaces to poor people and to homeless people, such as Haley Plaza, UN Plaza, Civic Center Plaza, in order to please real estate and business interests, downtown corporate interests, and his sense of, what tourist interest would be. Anyway, Willie got pied, and his dignity was certainly called into question. I guess people saw pie on his face, and Willie got enraged, went ballistic, and had these three people, in essence, tried and sentenced to 6 months in jail apiece for pushing a pie in his face, where he suffered no significant damage whatsoever, possibly a cleaning bill to one of his expensive suits, although I don't even know if he was wearing a suit at the time. Anyway, here's a song about that incident. Check it out.
meet your doom, the biotic speaking brigade. Watch them sailing through the air in the boardroom, see them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers. Watch that sailing through the air in the boardroom, see them shiver. You can spend your life hoping for pie in the sky, but the baking brigade delivers.
Hey, Third, we're talking to.
My name is Shay Laus.
And Shay, you're a man who's been sleeping in your vehicle?
That is correct.
And what happened?
I happened to be on campus at the time. I was with my friend Eric here. And we were late at a party at someone on campus. We got on campus through one of the checkpoints because we were with someone who lives there. And we left the party late. There's no room in his apartment to sleep, and so we went and kicked it in our vehicle. We're awakened the next morning by a cop who had
UC or Santa Cruz Police?
Campus police, so I don't know what that is. And basically what he had done was I had a broken window in my van, and he opened up the door and came in and shining the flashlight on us and basically broke into my vehicle to see if we were in there.
The name of the officer was?
Just one sec.
And you were this is your friend this happened?
Yeah. I live with him in the vehicle. We both live.
You were a witness to the officer's illegal entry into the vehicle?
Yes, definitely. He shined the light right into my face. And we'd be drinking the night before, and we thought it was just reasonable for us to stay in campus where it was free that weekend, and we didn't think we were going to get hassled at all. And he just intruded, and he already had the tickets already written out, ready to go before we even knew there was anyone in there. He had it already written down when we came out.
Do you have your ticket with you?
I don't have my ticket with me. He has this with him. We got them at the same time.
All right. Let's take a look at that. Okay, this looks like a ticket here. It was given on Saturday, lot 164. UCSC sleeping in vehicle. Now, this is a violation of the UCSC copycat sleeping ban.
That is correct.
Which is different than the city ban, but it really takes its cue from the city ban. You know, I'll give you a flyer about it, Jerry.
Awesome. Yeah. It is different.
A little different. Sleeping in a vehicle. Here, let me take a look. I'll check it out. And you, were you involved with these two men?
No, I'm involved with them, but not that night.
I would hope not. We'll learn more of these salacious details in a moment.
And you're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. That was a brief snippet from an interview prior to the Tuesday's City Council meeting last week when the Byers City Council essentially rubber-stamped her proposal to do nothing significant about the sleeping ban other than lower the fine. So it's now only $54 per night of sleep life-sustaining activity for every time you do that in Santa Cruz, outside, or in a vehicle. And the police officers choose to ticket you, that's a $54 fine. It has to also be mentioned, for the sake of accuracy, that the number of actual tickets in the city has dropped drastically, I think in large part due to this examination, so I guess we can credit the discussion, which I have attacked as being goose chase-ish and not to the point and really raising everybody's expectations without good reason, and exhausting everyone and raising people's fears on the other side without good reason, polarizing the community and not providing a real debate, but just an opportunity to say we debated without actually really doing the debate, so you can, quote, move on to the next subject without having done anything on the last subject. Still, what was done, when some say that this discussion has resulted in the police department taking a low profile for a lot of sleepers and even some campers who have campsites, and I've heard that from people out at the Homeless Services Center, and I think that has to be said, that bringing up this issue publicly, because of the absurdity and the cruelty of arresting people for sleeping or ticketing them or even harassing them, which apparently continued to a significant degree in spite of the discussion, the harassment, even when the ticketing dropped, It causes police officers to have to think twice about this because much as they may want that as a tool, if they begin to look ridiculous around this issue, then perhaps somebody will actually start looking at the real ridiculous stuff around the drug war and the kinds of things that really are creating the police state or have created the police state that we are in now in Santa Cruz, and start taking away those much more significant tools that the police have. Sounds like an incoming call.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Hi, Uncle Robert. David Silva here.
Hi, David.
It's good to hear you mentioning the positive aspects of this long struggle that we've been in,
mm-hmm.
and some of the results. There are many more. It sure doesn't look like it. You know, when we were at City Council last Tuesday, that was one of the saddest gatherings of people. I mean, everybody was just pretty much sad, beaten down, you know, really disappointed. But, you know, let's try to give ourselves some credit that we have moved the process along. The population is much more aware of the actual, you know, camping ordinance and the actual sleeping ban than they were, much, much more aware than they were. You know, more people are now horrified by the language that still, even with the changes in the camping ordinance, the definition of camping, you know, alone issue is something that we've accomplished. We've got the Sentinel to not only start using the phrase sleeping ban in its articles, but actually now we've even had it on a headline. That's pretty cold comfort for someone that's sleeping outside, but for those of us that are struggling on the political and the legislative and the ordinal front, we know that that's significant, that the Sentinel is calling us, you know, it by its true name, that this for the first time in, what, 20-some years, the changes made have been actually a stopping of the direction that it was going in before. Before, it was a train running over the homeless. Now, we're stopping and redirecting it. The direction may not... I don't even think that they're baby steps. I think they're less than baby steps. It's just a redirecting of the direction, you know, the re-aiming of the direction it's going to be going. And, of course, with our grand commission that we're going to be having, we're going to be taking some giant steps in the next 6 months because we're all going to participate. And the whole community is going to come together.
Uh-huh.
And of course, you know, the fact that people have to sleep outside, you know, I'm now trying to use the phrase outdoor houseless survival sleeping. You know, houseless survival sleeping, you know, is what's been under attack by so many blind and bigoted people. And these bigoted people are full of fear, and now maybe they're less full of fear. There's people, business people have come out. I think we've made some progress. It would have been nice if we had had a real revolution at the polls, and we would have just been able to, they would have been able to recognize the best way to get done with the sleep ban is just to wipe it out now.
You know, David, I think we did have a real revolution at the polls.
Yeah.
What we didn't have was the polls respecting the polls. That's the problem.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I know that... My sense with the business people and the neighbors is though they were, you know, enraged and ranting and raving about the camping ordinance.
You don't say they were. It was really just a few.
Well, those who came to the meetings.
It was just really just a few people that I think had best interests, like cops grabbed.
Sure. Even though they were doing that, I think that they had largely resigned themselves to there being significant changes because they saw
much more significant than we got
four votes on the city council, and
they came there thinking the camping ordinance was going to be overturned.
Right, and of course what Catherine did was, and you know, because she had to explain to voters why they wouldn't do it after this, you know, sea change in the election. She I think cleverly got that whole thing set up by taking on the broader camping ordinance, mobilizing the right wing, and then just sort of without real explanation. Dropping out on February 1st, she said.
That's one way of looking at it, but there's another way of looking at that thing.
Hang on a second, David.
Yeah.
I'll let you go ahead in a moment.
Yeah.
She said that, you know, on February 1st, you were there. She, even on the very first day when the subcommittee, the task force, as I call it, was beginning going to talk about changes in the law, she sort of unilaterally announced there would be no significant changes in the sleeping ban, period. And that kind of, I guess, she had previously told the two council members who had publicly favored those changes, Crone and Sugar, and actually introduced some minor measures. Well, they were good measures, but they were introduced sort of at the last minute to make some changes. That stopped the entire discussion. I mean, there was no discussion of why can't homeless people sleep? I mean, what about what's wrong with each of these areas that supposedly, you know, is off limits for homeless people? Why can't this industrial area be used? And that debate never took place.
Yeah, unfortunately, you know, the process was very, very questionable. But let's look at it a possible another way. Let's give Catherine some benefit of the doubt here. By raising the entire camping ordinance, she raised as much hackles as going to be raised. She showed the maximum amount of hackles, and they are few. They seem to have great impact on the results, but they are few. The majority of the actual neighbors in the actual neighborhoods did want to do something, and the thing that came out over and over again, which is something that by her doing that, we actually kind of got a stealth victory, is that everyone in town agrees now that there needs to be a safe zone or safe place. And what Catherine's charged when she said that I'm not willing to do, when she said her I'm not willing to do speech, says in my heart I know that this has to be done, but I'm not willing, I don't think there's community, she is willing to look at the safe space when this new Grand Commission comes back to her. And I'm holding her to a word on that. I'm holding them all to the word on that. This Grand Commission will, you know, find safe places. I have a feeling that Harvey West is not going to be a place where you have overnight vehicular sleeping because it's heavily impacted. It's going to be a place where maybe a tent city, right. But I think the overnight vehicular sleeping is probably
going to
go
down,
to the
David. You're
west
going,
side.
Slow down. You're going through a lot of good points. I want to kind of refer to them.
Yeah, let's go through them all. Okay. Let's go through all the changes they actually made.
But wait, I want to talk about some of the things that you're talking about now. I don't know that any of the diehards who are on the Downtown Neighbors or the Harvey West Association or the Downtown Merchants, Downtown Association, really changed their position at all in the progress of this discussion. I was at all the hearings.
They changed it when they thought they were losing. When they found out they were winning, they changed it back. If you witnessed
Right. Well, that may be. But, I mean, I think it may be a little, dare I use the word, Pollyanna-ish to suggest that. Yeah, well, of anyone.
Go
I mean,
ahead.
Not necessarily you personally,
go
but
ahead.
Just the idea. And you're trying to look at it from a positive perspective, and I appreciate that.
So I'm trying to give us encouragement. I mean,
of course,
it's real easy for us to be discouraged, and it's going to be disastrous for us to stay discouraged.
No, I don't think we should stay discouraged. No question about it. I mean, I think the rights, the need for people to rights, will eventually encourage all of us because that's something that we feel deeply, and I think that everybody in some place in their in their heart of hearts feels too. But I mean, I think that. For example, the problem I have with this new task force, they're talking about
starting the Grand Commission.
Yeah, you call it the Grand Commission, I call it the new task force. The problem I have with it is that it seems to me that, again, I look at the bad experiences of other task forces on homelessness in other areas like Santa Barbara, like the county, and I see that nothing has happened. These are ways of, it marches off to nowhere. Now, that doesn't mean this has to happen here. That's one concern. But also the composition is going to be appointments by council members. You're going to have this task force appointed partially by such.
Well, it hasn't been decided exactly yet how that's going to take place.
Right. Yeah, well, that's true, but I understand that. Well, it depends. That's quite true. But some people are talking about let's get all the businesses and everybody in town together for a grand consensus. And I guess I don't really think that you're going to get businesses in on the ground level for a grand consensus when they feel that the mayor is on their side and is going to keep things as it is. And that apparently is what she showed. And I was really blown away when she said at the March council meeting, when Mayor Byers said that 2 weeks after this process began, she decided there could be no debate and no discussion between the two sides. They just wouldn't talk to each other. And, of course,
I found that kind of strange because she was on record in the press and on record in several meetings talking about how pleased she was with the fact that consensus was coming together for at least the first 6 weeks. Now, I would say there was a turning point when the Downtown Neighborhood Association Steering Committee didn't really get the support of the Downtown Neighborhood Association that they wanted, and they came and lied about it at the public forum that was the cover for having lacked so many real neighborhood meetings. Talking to a few steering committee members here and there of some neighborhood group that's organized around COPS grants is not talking to the neighborhood about I was kind of surprised by that too. I don't think it was 2 weeks, Catherine. I think it was more like 6 weeks.
Well, I mean, I kind of take her at her word that she decided early on that she didn't want to do anything. Yeah. And
I think that was the big clue that she really wants to pass it on to the Grand Commission. Mm-hmm. And this Grand Commission can. In other words, somebody other than the council and the mayor must take the blame for this. We need someone with some stature like a Gordon Pusser or somebody that actually believes that, you know, yeah, understands that the sleeping sections is a human rights violation.
Well,
therefore,
there has
to be safe zone. Someone
yeah,
with that, yeah, with a great amount of public
community
stature.
I don't deny that.
Has to take the heat.
I don't deny that that could be done.
Yeah.
I don't think Catherine wants to, you know, is looking for a way out or would want somebody else to take the blame. I mean, she's the one who initiated all this stuff in the first place. She's the one who put this thing on the agenda as the camping ordinance,
yeah,
you know. I mean, she took the initiative, I guess, and that's why I know Sugar and Crone are forever praising her and saying, we would never have done anything if it weren't for her, you know, when in fact, of course, I think she was moving to cover their asses so they wouldn't have to do anything because they were going to follow her no matter what she did right down this disastrous road.
Well, we put a little pressure on them, too, between October and December.
Of course we did.
You know, we had a pretty hard struggle just getting it on the December 8th agenda.
I know that this issue certainly, I mean, there are some positive aspects. I think that the magnet theory has been effectively discredited. I
yeah,
think in the next few weeks we'll learn that the...
Now, what we have to replace it with is the family reunification theory.
Yeah, hang on. In the next few weeks, and I want to talk to you about that,
yeah,
we will find that that Rotkin's theories about campgrounds failing will also be discredited. I've just been reading about, you probably heard, Jacksonville's planning a
yeah,
campground,
yeah,
Tampa's having a campground. So, and it may be possible we may even get the grand old scoundrel of the sleeping ban, Rotkin, on board. In fact, I'm hoping that you will be able to castigate him personally on the air on, I guess it'll be Tuesday, is that April 8th? Do I have that date
yeah,
right? Tuesday, April 8th, you're going to be talking yeah, to Mike Rotkin in a debate
okay,
on
as
the
far
station.
As castigating goes... You know,
Wait a minute. Between 6 and 8
on this
station, you're going to be debating with Councilmember Mike Rotkin on the issue of the sleeping ban. Are you up to it?
I've been waiting for it for 2 years.
I see.
I mean, the man has not met with me. The man has not faced me on this issue. You know, he'll let me make a 3-minute speech at City Council, and then he'll spend 20 minutes here and 20 minutes there and 20 minutes there on different aspects of what I said and countermanding it. One with theory that sounds good, and then with evidence that is lies. You know, I'm quite willing for anybody to put forward any theory, but if the theory is hollow and does not hold ground in reality, you know, then that theory needs to be challenged. However, if the theory is upheld with lies, then it does have to be then he does have to be called on that. And I would like to get him in a one-on-one debate because then I can match his lies and say, you know, that's not true. That's not what we're talking about. And this, his talent for changing the subject from the sleeping ban to the camping ban, you know, we fought with for years. And that's really probably been our, you know, of all the successes we've made this past year and a half, to get in most everybody's mind that there's a difference between the sleeping ban and the camping ban is, you know, unfortunately, such a little distinction,
mm-hmm,
what he would call a distinction without a difference.
So that is going to be happening.
It's an important thing that we've accomplished.
Yeah, it is going to be happening on
yeah,
April 8th at 6 o'clock.
Yeah.
Actually, it starts at 6:30, I guess, is when he's going to arrive. But I will be monitoring the two of you so that you don't, you know, embrace in tears and hug each other too soon.
Well, yeah, but, you know, because we do need him. He does have an ability. He does have talents, and he is concerned, you know, about social and human rights issues. I think a little more on the social services, and the human rights somehow gets lost in the police enforcement aspects of things with him. But, you know, cruddy old Marxists that are in too much power, they have a Stalinist bent.
Let me change the subject to kind of a related topic. The organizations that endorse the initiative to repeal the sleeping ban, which you and I and others worked so hard for and got so many thousands of signatures for
yeah,
last year, included WILP, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network, Rascals, I guess Radical Action, Student Coalition Against Lies and Suppression,
yeah,
up at campus, Students Against the Sleeping Ban, Lawyers Against the Sleeping
Black
Ban, Santa
Alliance
Cruz Action Network. Now, Santa Cruz Action Network is having a meeting in early April.
April 12th.
And for 3 years, it has had as a significant priority, if I understand their motions correctly, the end of the Santa Cruz City Sleeping Ban. And yet, of course, no SCAN person stood up and spoke on March 23rd on that issue. Can you explain this for me?
Yeah, they all spoke February 23rd, and I spent a good deal of time trying to get people to come March 23rd, and everybody was saying, It's a done deal. It's useless. We're wasting our time. This, you know, I mean, I got from old town progressives that have been around for a long time. Their hope in these newly elected really, really replenished by what they saw happen February 23rd, and how much even take away from what happened February 23rd. They even backed off from February 23rd with giving us even less. So there was a lot. I mean, to try to get people to come March 23rd was very difficult. I mean, it was, you know,
so hard. You would have thought that organizations that had officially endorsed the scan hasn't changed its position as far as I know, yeah. That they would have had been responsible to bring this issue up, and it seems to me further...
Even people that are on the Committee to Repeal the Sleeping Ban from the start that participated in the writing of this just said, what's the use of coming March 23rd? I mean, it was, you know, that whole month of supposedly going back to community didn't happen.
Well,
they went to the Chamber of Commerce.
We know these politicians... No, getting these politicians to respond is not a cakewalk and not a backdoor deal. It requires, you know, right on, front page, you know, protest and pressure... from the word go, and when we get the sleeping ban done, we're going to have to worry about decriminalizing homeless people downtown, decriminalizing homeless people around such things as the open container law, as far as I'm concerned, for instance, so that adults can have the same right to engage in non-abusive behaviors that the rest of us have in our own homes.
I mean, all the anti-homeless laws, I think we probably should have a large movement, just like there's a big movement now for a downtown plaza. That goes hand in hand with the right to hang out, which the Downtown Association was on record as being against, that no one has a right to hang out downtown. And they've had to reverse their position on that. And I think all the anti-homeless laws also start being part of this whole new movement of this new government that we have.
Well,
the government wants to have
people-friendly. What I'm saying, David, is that getting even these first steps is not going to happen through sweetheart deals in the back room.
Of course not.
It's not going to happen through, oh, gosh, I thought it was okay, and now I'm so discouraged because they're voting against it.
Yeah.
I think it's even more important that we turn out big time in different protests. Now, it may be better to spend our time and energy in, you know, public protests in front of the Sentinel, and, you know, setting up
setting up a
redwood summer kind of thing where we're hanging from the trees downtown and protesting downtown and boycotts. You suggested a rolling boycott at one point. That may be, but I think that until we reach that point and are doing those things, we have to continue to kick the asses of these people right down the road. And I think, for example, the scan meeting.
Which people?
The council members who are backing off from their promises. The police officer, the higher echelons of the police department that are misinforming the public about this and the
Well, I've said for a long time that when it comes to the sleeping ban issue, it's a police administration problem more than anything else. It's their problem, not the neighbors, the business's problem. They've held it up as an excuse for them to get out of doing the work and to beefing up their numbers. And that's what's going on in the city. The neighbors, some of the neighborhoods have bought it, and some of the businesses have bought it. And it's time they wise up. We're going to be working with the businesses, local businesses, to try to keep corporations out of Santa Cruz soon.
Right. But again, what I'm driving at here is that let's take a look at the scan situation. Scans, one of the kingmakers. Well, it has been historically the kingmaker in town behind the current city council majorities. Now, don't we want to bring back the scan to demand that people like Catherine Byers be made accountable? I mean, what is she doing voting in favor of the sleeping ban when SCAN has been against it for 3 years? I mean, isn't it appropriate to call for a vote of censure for people of this sort who are doing these kinds of things?
Mike Rock has been endorsed by the Peace and Freedom Party and every socialist and every, you know, progressive organization in town for forever. He's got every single nomination.
Not recently, though. Except
the Green Party. Yeah, including the last election.
Well, that was 96.
96.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't run in 98.
No, he didn't.
Yeah, I'm saying, so the question of accountability, it was a big, big question in SCAN right now because of the Beach Area Working Group, because of the council members' refusal to move on the sleeping ban.
Anyway, would you recommend that people come to the SCAN meeting and,
absolutely,
you know,
absolutely,
you know, hang them high, or at least demand that there be a real turnaround and a second vote?
Well, let me paint a picture of what they're walking into then first. What you're walking into, you're walking into an organization that mostly has operated on an electoral level, but it's all its members are mostly interested in activists, you know, are involved in other activist organizations, except, let's say, there's a lot of elders that are still participating in this through this forum. It, in the past, has had the situation where the liberals, the Democrats, sort of controlled and had the last word of everything, the veto power on everything, including the door hanger. But the radicals and the true progressives and CalPERS type students and so forth had to do all the footwork. The Greens and everybody did all the footwork when the Democrats at the last minute would come in and veto things and change the door hanger, whatever they want to do. Those Democrats have now been driven out of SCAN, not on purpose, but they've left in droves.
You're talking about people like Kennedy and Darling.
They've left. Now the problem is with the radicals like us being discouraged. If we don't come in there and hold so that void doesn't get wider, those Democrats and those liberals are going to rush back in and take SCAN back over. We do need to have people that are really, you know, the activists in this town that are the front line people. That anybody that works on the front line on this issue is usually pretty much on the right side of this issue. It's the people that sit back and abstract about things like Mike Rodkin that have the wrong position on this issue. Just about anybody that works on the front line, you know, knows that it's a stupid, stupid law, and knows that most of the anti-homeless laws, you know, are just part of the war on the poor, part of the war on drugs, and it's a way to keep these coffers and the police administrations, you know, turning over and keep the prison industrial complex going. They know that. People on the front line know that. The people who are do-gooder, knee-jerk liberals, you know, want to keep, or those people that are simply progressives, except not in my backyard, you know, want to have Santa Cruz stay pretty and clean and green and want to hide their head in the sand, you know, have been the problem. Those people now have been called out on this issue, and the whole town's talking about it, and so we should not lose the advantage by abandoning SCAN. SCAN is going to be an important organization to keep this new coalition together. The new coalition has been very, very much put in jeopardy by the city council not moving further than it should have.
So what do you suggest people do?
I suggest they show up at SCAN. They should have already joined to be a member by February 12th in order to vote March 12th. I think they'll be very interested to see that we're putting in new accountability.
March
and April. We are putting in the new accountability procedure that we worked on all summer, so that from now on all our endorsed candidates will have an accountability process that they have to go through. They can't just do things and then not be accounted for. So we do have an accountability process we've been working on for quite a while, and I can't think of very many other organizations in town that do. You know, that's probably one of the problems, that there's so many, we're such a heavily decentralized new left, heavily decentralized activist, you know, community, with not that many, very many accountability procedures in place.
Now, let me ask you this. For the last 9 months or so, almost every month, you, among almost of all people, have kind of put together a colorful event called Don't Sleep Tonight.
Don't Sleep Tonight Night.
Now, what is that all about?
Well, it has many folds, but the last night of each month, unless it's something like Halloween or New Year's, or something else. We're asking people to participate in some way to, first of all, get a sense of what it's like yourself to be sleep deprived. So we're asking you to start out participating by just maybe trying to stay awake all night, the last night of the month. Once you do that, report to City Hall what your results are. Call them up. Call 420-5020. Tell them, I couldn't stay awake. How in the hell are you making these homeless people stay awake, even without shelter? Then we're asking people to go a little further the next time they participate, not to cover up with a blanket. Try being without a blanket. There's a blanket ban. Try being without a blanket all night long. You know, as we get closer to summer, that becomes less and less of an issue. But even in the summer, you'll find you know, in a coastal town, to not have a blanket on it, even indoors, can be pretty chilling. Then we're asking people to also support whatever demonstrations the theme of that particular month is. One month we had My Car Is My Home, Leave Me Alone. A lot of people did a lot of artistic and creative participation. We're asking, once you've done that, once you've tried not to sleep, then to participate fully, and then it goes to the level of civil disobedience. At some point it's going to be to the level where I imagine there's going to be a core of this group that's going to insist that no city employee, no city manager, no city council member should be allowed to stay awake that night. You know, it's going to probably come to that point in civil disobedience. But before we do that, I think we should probably put a lawn chair on their lawn and camp out on their lawn, the city council's lawn. So it has to be an escalating thing, but it has to escalate with discipline in terms of civil disobedience. I don't think we can do things wild-eyed without having at least purified ourselves a little bit.
Right.
Try and have stayed awake ourselves.
Well,
if we can't say that we try to do it ourselves, then we can't impose it on anybody else.
Well, I think, you know, I'm going to propose, and
Gandhi's grandson says we should just be pitching tents
now. I'm going to propose to the audience and to anyone out there who's concerned about the right for all of us to sleep at night, that we institute Don't Sleep Tonight Night, My Car Is My Home, Leave Me Alone 2, and show up and park downtown, and maybe have some hot coffee for homeless people who are awake that time of night,
Now, the thing about this particular one is let me finish my proposal first.
Sorry, Robert. What we did last time, this was in December, at the end of the month in December, we had a kind of speak out in front of the Bookshop Santa Cruz, which, although Neil Coonerty, the owner of Bookshop Santa Cruz, is very, actually is very positively minded toward homeless people that he relates to personally, has an open restroom, hires homeless people, and I think he was letting a homeless man sleep in his doorway, the doorway of his place, although that's illegal, and the police could arrest that person for violating the camping or sleeping sections of the camping ordinance. Nonetheless, he initiated the downtown ordinances. He was actually quite an outspoken voice in favor of the sleeping ban on the, you know, the task force process. And so we kind of identify him as a very strong downtown merchant voice for retaining these oppressive laws. So we were there. We also, you know, had people who were not homeless park their vehicles with big signs on them and displays on top of them, maybe a sleeping bag and so forth, saying, you know, my car is my home, leave me alone. We had some hot coffee for people. You could come and sit in a person's car with them and, you know, kind of hang out in a warm place for a while. It actually broke up around midnight.
Yeah.
But I think it might be worthwhile to do again. I'd like to get some input from people out there who are listening. What do you think of the idea, David?
Well, you know, I think the overnight vehicular sleeping, as distinguished from, you know, self-contained camping, overnight vehicular sleeping is one of the areas that can be the least impact and yet give the greatest relief, least impact on the neighbors and communities, can give the greatest relief to those who have vehicles and their friends. And it was unfortunate that the city council members, when they were dealing with the driveway issue, that they didn't make a distinction between overnight vehicular sleeping or with the business parking lots and camping. They let rock and run the whole thing into as if people are going to be having bonfires in the middle of their cars, in the middle of the driveways. I mean, that's not what we were talking about. So I think overnight vehicular sleeping can probably give relief to the homeless, a large sector. Anytime we can, with a stroke of a pen, give relief to a large sector of people and have a slight impact, I think it's something we should have done. The fact that they talked about it as camping instead of overnight vehicular sleeping gave more weight to our rock and side of the argument. Then here comes the 72-hour restriction. So I think the demonstration for overnight vehicular sleeping is really important. My car's my home, leave me alone is an important message that I think everybody understands. The people say, yeah, you know, just leave people alone. You know, let the laws get out of the way of people that are trying to survive.
We're talking to David Silva here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM on your FM dial. David, that about wraps it up for
this call. Like I was repeating myself a lot, but I just wanted to reiterate again, we did stop the direction that this anti-homeless law was going. It is pointed with, even the sleeping in blanket sections are now for the first time distinguished as not rising to misdemeanor in those within that 24-hour period. That's not much, but it's distinguished within the ordinance for the first time. We have a couple new areas where there are more cars can come in for a very, very brief period of time, but at least it shows an expansion of area, which, you know, with safe zones, and distinguishing sleeping from camping from the rest of, sleeping from camping. Those are two important things, and they did that much, but I don't call it a baby step, I just think they sort of stopped, did a bit of an about face. You know, they didn't really take steps. They just sort of stopped, did a bit of about face. So now this commission, this grand commission, has a very large charge to take those steps.
I appreciate your input, David, and let's talk again.
Okie dokie.
All right.
Bye.
I'm going to pay the poll tax. I want to pay the poll tax. I'd love to pay the poll tax. It's just the tax for me. My grand will pay the poll tax. My kids will pay the poll tax. My cats will pay the poll tax. And so will you and me. MPs will pay the poll tax. VIPs will pay the poll tax. Mrs. T will pay the poll tax. So it's the tax for me. Hand or foot or thumb tax. Elbow, knee or bum tax. It ain't insane or dumb tax, it's any tax for me. I would pay a rain tax, a train, a grain, a drain tax. But if they make a brain tax, it won't apply to me or Mrs. T.
And that's a brief bit from Peggy Seeger and Ewan McCall. Naming Names, talking about English law and laws that oppress people, poll tax being one of those laws. Well, David Silva had lots of good and interesting things to say, and we actually caught him and Chris Crone, well, not quite with their pants down, but talking up a storm on Club Cruise, and I guess that show is, it's either, I think it's already been aired, and it's probably maybe aired again. It's discussion of what actually happened at the city council meeting, what they did. Now, we've kind of summarized that already, so I'm probably going to play less of this than I was going to. In fact, what I think I will do is postpone this because we did kind of talk about it. For those of you who don't know, the city council made some minor, what I call cosmetic changes in the sleeping sections of the camping ordinance, and they made sleeping and covering up with blankets an infraction rather than a misdemeanor. It almost always was charged as an infraction anyway. It lowered the fine to $54 and 8 hours community service maximum. Said you could sleep in a vehicle in a driveway for 3 days of the month maximum with permission of the owner. And also said that you could, two businesses could, a business could have two cars parking on a parking lot with the permission of the business.
Hi, you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Robert, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good.
I wanted to talk about SCAN, Santa Cruz Action Network.
Okay.
In hopefully polite terms.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not aware of a single difficult issue, certainly in the 90s, that SCAN has gotten behind and done anything with.
Well, they have taken a formal position on ending the sleeping ban on 3 separate years running.
Did they get active on it?
Well, Skip Spitzer did lick a few envelopes, and they included a few things in their newsletter, but I think that what David Silva said is kind of accurate. They don't get active on issues, they get active around election campaigns.
Well,
have you found that to be the case? Or?
They get active on school bonds. They will use their clout for certain issues.
Right, but those are elections, right?
Well, school bonds, certainly
the votes.
The sleeping ban repeal initiative was an election issue. They could have gotten much more solidly behind it.
That's true.
And I've heard the claim over the years of how SCAN is oriented towards electing people into office, but they have a lot of clout. They take positions on issues. A lot of members of the community look to them for credibility of issues. I wonder why that is. I'm not claiming I know, but I'm not aware of an issue of merit that I have seen SCAN get active on, certainly in the 90s, and even going back further than that.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder where this credibility of the Santa Cruz Action Network comes from. And I don't see SCAN doing anything really cutting edge. I see them as an impediment to a lot of social progress, a lot of issues coming above board and being dealt with properly.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's an impediment. I think in many ways, and I hope it's a polite way to say this, a SCAN is by and large a ruse and a diversion.
Well, what do you think of David Silva's concern that we should all go to the SCAN meeting on April 8th to make sure that the Kennedy, Rodkin, Darling types don't take it over again?
Well, I think the SCAN has a future that is meaningful. It would include gutting the steering committee. All right. I think what it is now is it's essentially mediocre individuals who want to claim that they're some kind of activists when in reality they're not. And when in reality what they have is a lot of clout on the west side, and they have an established member base, and they're taken seriously by people. And I think SCAN has lost credibility over the years to the point where it is actually at this point in time an impediment, and it's something that needs to be dealt around.
Hmm. So you wouldn't recommend going to the SCAN meeting?
Somebody wants to go to the SCAN meeting, that's their business. But if you're looking to SCAN to get involved in any kind of a leadership way in important issues, in rock the boat issues, it ain't going to happen. And I bring up the school bond issue. You know, SCAN is touted, as you said before, about how they're election-oriented and they want to get candidates in office. Well, school bonds was one of the issues that SCAN got behind. recently. And certainly during the whole school bond push, it was never mentioned that what are school bonds? School bonds are tax-free income for wealthy people. So if you're going to pump a school bond and push a school bond, that ought to be brought above board. I find SCAN to have become a very, very mediocre organization that is in no way to be taken seriously as any kind of an activist organization. I was before the SCAN steering committee once, and almost 4 years ago, in early April of 90. What is this organization? It is, and I'm not trying to cut anybody down, and a lot of the individual people I think are wonderful people, but as an organization, I think it is a misrepresentation of political activism.
Well, I know that you've been active around the Sleeping Ban Repeal Initiative, and you gave us a lot of the benefit of your expertise, and you did some significant signature gathering last year, and you've spoken, I think, even on the air about the importance of, you know, maybe a tripartite initiative next year for pedestrian malls, sleeping ban repeal, and rent control.
We will have the paperwork for the, it was either the late 70s, early 80s, previous Santa Cruz rent control initiative within a couple of weeks. So there will be a model to base a rent control initiative on shortly. And to me, this might be a very, very interesting way to bring together the activist community in Santa Cruz, of which there are numerous, and certainly the initiative process can be a way to engage a lot of people, and I think it would be a very exciting way to go. I think it would make for the summer of 1999 very exciting.
Well, now, are you going to bring your bike down for Don't Sleep Tonight night and offer a homeless person a cup of coffee on your bike on Wednesday night?
That may well be, now that things are loosening up for me. I do want to stick with the SCAN issue for a bit, Robert, because I think over the next couple of weeks that these initiatives are going to begin to take shape and gel. And certainly I think by early April there'll be some filing happening. So this is a developing issue. But SCAN, I think it needs to be openly discussed as to what the nature of SCAN is in practical reality. And is it an impediment to really bringing up issues, or does it do any good? What are they really about?
Well, the question I would have to kind of focus on has to do with civil rights for the poor. And if anybody wants to call in on that issue, plus, of course, I want your opinion on whether Don't Sleep Tonight, My Car Is My Home, Leave Me Alone, Too, is a good idea, can give a call here to 427-3772. Is there more you'd like to say, Bob?
Well, I'd like to hear other callers' feedback on the Santa Cruz Action Network and its legitimacy as the so-called forefront Santa Cruz political action organization.
Well, perhaps
they really have the right to that claim in the late 1990s, and haven't they not shown themselves to be incapable of any true bold positions on anything?
All right. Well, the hamster here has thrown out the challenge, and let's see if anybody picks up the gauntlet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Bye. Bye.
Happy John Pine was a friend of mine, lived here by the sea. Down on the streets of Santa Cruz, he always laughed at me. Abby and I went to church one night, thank God, and ate our fill. Asked him if he had any money, give me a fake dollar bill. Where is Happy? He's gone away. And it's hard for me to be happy. Happy's in a grave. Oh, where is Happy? Shot downstate. And it's guess the police are happy. Sadness is here to stay. Happy was as harmless as a butterfly. Loved everyone he met. He never left the 60s. Didn't really care for the internet. One day he was grooving to some tunes and doing the happy bop when a bullet entered his chest. Came from a Santa Cruz cop. Where is Happy? Shot down today. And it's hard for me to be happy. Happy's in a grave. Oh, where is Happy? He's gone away. And I guess the police are happy. Sadness here to stay. Now people like happy, I do believe. Heaven is great, great spirits. You know, like whatever you got here, less of, you got more there. Could happen. So I think he's up there. I think he's looking down. And he's probably saying, hey man, right on. I know you. Power to the people. Where is happy? It's gone away. And it's hard for me to be happy. Happy's in a grave. Where is happy? Shot down today. And I guess the police are happy. Sadness is here to say, yeah, I guess the police are happy. Sadness is here to say.
And that's not the ballad of Happy John Dine, but just Happy, by one of our local songsters, Randy Hale. And a really great song about a man who was shot by the Santa Cruz police in an incident still not given any independent investigation. And one more poor person, one more activist dead without significant concern by any of our established institutions. Well, first a correction. The debate between David Silva and Councilmember Mike Rotkin is going to be happening Thursday, not Tuesday. If I said Tuesday, I misspoke myself. Thursday, April 8th, starts at, well, the show begins at 6. The debate will probably begin at 6:30. That's when Mike Rotkin will be in the studio, unless we can get him to come a little earlier. And it'll run until 8 o'clock. That's, again, Thursday, April 8th. From 6:30 to 8, a debate on the issue of the sleeping ban in Santa Cruz. I'll be moderating and making sure that Mike doesn't beat up David and that David doesn't tongue lash Mike too badly. I mean, we have to make sure we're on an even playing field here. And there will be a sergeant at arms to arrest anybody who speaks for more than 3 minutes. I was thinking possibly Catherine Byers could perform that role if she's free that evening. It's interesting. Celia Scott never arrested anyone in her whole time as mayor. I don't think she even had anyone removed from the council chambers. I'm not aware that she did, whereas Byers has already begun to devolve into that kind of threatening demeanor. She did that at the last council meeting on March 23rd. And interestingly enough, that to me showed the deterioration of this so-called progressive. Well, Tim Fitzmaurice was really the main culprit here. A council member who showed more concern for making sure that people who have for years been denied their basic rights, if they speak up in anger, if they speak up in mockery when a bigot comes up to the mic and starts talking about homeless people being criminals and child molesters, it's not that the person is being dragged off, it's not like the person is being assailed with tomatoes. But if somebody expresses a groan or an exclamation of mockery, that is suddenly becomes a pretext for saying that there's some intimidating process going on. And of course, the real intimidation is that people like Fitzmaurice, who've had months to educate themselves, just haven't gotten the message. They don't seem to understand that there is no shelter space for most people, and that they're living under the fear of being arrested for sleeping, and significant numbers of people are being harassed and have to worry about that, and others are being beaten up because they can't sleep in safe places. Yet Fitzmaurice's priorities seem to be making sure that upper middle class people from the west side are able to have an absolutely quiet house when they utter their hate speech. I suppose it's a form of protecting a certain part of the First Amendment, but if you don't protect the rest of it, it's pretty horrible. And I think that it leaves a real bad taste in my mouth. Of course, again, I'm pretty fed up with the council members. I think I told Chris Krohn a couple of days ago, he asked to meet with me. You may recall about a week or two ago, he said he wanted to meet and then didn't really meet in time for the council meeting for us to do anything. He never really raised the issues at the city council meeting in any coherent legal way that provided for us to present an alternative to the community, which would say, look, decriminalize sleeping somewhere. Instead, he talked about, he read some good letters at the council meeting and then introduced this kind of proposal that said people should be allowed to park in a driveway, not limited by the three-day-a-month restriction that is now will become law. By the way, all these changes will become law on April 23rd, a month after the city council has met and passed the second reading. And I'm really dismayed with what happens to activists when they join the city council. I mean, I've always had this feeling. People said to me, why don't you run for city council? And I said, because it would corrupt me, because it would load me up with all kinds of issues which I'm unprepared to deal with and which eventually, you know, would sink the real issues I'm concerned with. And I think that that's what's happened to Crone, Fitzmaurice, and Sugar. You know, at least that's how it looks to me at this point. There's someone saying, well, be patient, these folks are new in office, you know, give them time to get in the traces. They haven't even gotten interns going yet to help them with their work. You know, I mean, if Crone wants to set up a commission to look around for a bathroom, a commission, you know, I mean, a task force to look for a bathroom, I mean, it's, of course, the very idea is the subject of a comic skit, and that's really what we're going to start doing, is comic skits. But I told him all you need to do with that and a lot of these other issues is not to have some task force or commission, but have three or four people who are dedicated to your election, who are strong on this issue, to sit down and hold meetings and to throw meetings on the issue, and then to bring back their proposals to you, and then you could bring them to city council for public hearings. Once they seem to be a reasonable idea, not this kind of absurdly broad-based talk a thing to death forever process that Catherine Byers used around the sleeping ban sections of the camping ordinance, or the entire camping ordinance, actually. But, you know, ordinary public hearings. That's the normal legislative process, public hearings. But before you do that, you get your advocates together to iron out the kinks, to talk about what needs to be done, to go to the interest groups involved, and to form the proposals. Yeah, dump the downtown ordinances, dump the curfews, set up a mediation group that acts in the place of the police to go out and deal with problems that occur between class issues that happen between homeless people and people in houses or homeless people and merchants, as proposed by Celia Scott's mediation group back in 1995 in that $10,000 study that was funded by the city. It's all there waiting to be used. You know, you just need some people to sit down and work on it. You don't need some huge public process that is supposed to show everybody what a great Democrat you are. You're not a great Democrat when homeless people can't sleep at night. You're an oligarch. You know, you're a plutocrat. You're someone who lives in a society that's ruled by a few, that provides rights for a few, where money rules. That's the reality of it. So you can talk all you want about the pretense and the posture of public process. The real question is, do people have their rights in everyday life? You know, not does it suit the West Side, not is it going to make everybody happy all over the city, but is the city council making sure that happens? Is Chris Crone's sleep as a basic human right actually being introduced in a legal form so that sleep becomes a real human right instead of just being a nice little catchphrase that gets put into the a resolution by city council? And the answer is that we are seeing nothing of that kind being done right now. It wasn't done at the last council meeting. It isn't being planned. Crone asked me what I proposed he should do around this task force. I said, forget it. As I said, just get some people that you like who are strong on this issue to come together with some really good proposals for it. You don't need a task force. But if you insist on a task force, limit it to three questions, three big questions. One question, where are homeless people going to sleep? Let's go for that one fast, and let's work on it. Two, how can we restore civil rights for homeless people in the city in terms of letting them have access to public spaces again and stop being arrested under Neil Coonerty's, Mike Rotkin's, Cynthia Matthews' merchant-pleasing laws downtown? And, let's see, three... I'm not sure what I said for the third issue, but I suggested very simple questions, very quick questions, and don't spend a lot of time on them. Otherwise, you'll go nowhere, as Catherine Byers and her task force, and I think intentionally, pretty much, went nowhere, was steered nowhere.
I